So today's subject is a very significant topic from the perspective, from the standpoint of Indian philosophy, world philosophy, and so world religious traditions. Buddha and Shankaracharya, they are spiritual revolutionaries of India. Now, revolution is certainly not a very pleasant word. It reminds us of many things which are unpleasant, unfortunate, and tragic. But spiritual revolution is something very interesting. Now, in Vedantic tradition or from a spiritual perspective, a change doesn't come from outside. A change is from within. A change is not a radical transformation of an existing order. Which is what really happened whenever there was a revolution in the world. Think of French Revolution. There would be no Napoleonic Wars without French Revolution. And think of the Bolshevik Revolution, the cultural revolutions, all terrible things that caused a lot of pain, sufferings, death and destruction to millions of people. So we call them revolutions. And a revolution is a change, a radical transformation that is imposed upon an existing system. And there may be a change, but a change through revolution is only a change from worst to worst or from bad to worse. It's never a change for the better. It's always inevitably a change for the worse. That's what we call revolution. Think of the chaos, the bloodshed that accompanied French Revolution. The Bourbons wiped out. The guillotine was discovered. A very wonderful machine which only reminds us of tragedy and death. So, but there is another word in Vedantic tradition. It's called evolution. Evolution in Vedanta is called parinama. A parinama is essentially a change for the better. It's a refinement. It is a processing. It is a sublimation of an existing order of things, either in society, in nation, or in our own personal life. An evolution implies growth, a change for the better. A baby becomes a boy becomes a young man. It's inherent, inevitable. It's a growth and change from within. It's a natural process. It is spontaneous. It is not brought upon something by an external force. There is no compulsion involved in evolution. So, what I meant by the word revolution in this particular context was really evolution, that is growth. Now, straight away, I shall try to explain this in the context of Shankara and Buddha. Now, let us take Buddha first of all. Now, who was Buddha? Think of the age in which Buddha was born. Buddha was born roughly in 580, one of the more commonly accepted dates, popular among the historians and from the standpoint of recorded history. 560 to 460, he lived for 80 years, you have to count backward. That is 580 to 460, or something like that. Now, coming to Buddha's times, Buddha lived in a very difficult time in Indian context. So, in India's spiritual tradition and India's philosophical evolution, there are four important phases. One is that the period of Mahabharata, That is the period of Bhagavad Gita, the period of Sri Krishna, who is considered to be an incarnation in popular Hindu tradition, supposed to be born in 3300 BC. That's one of the accepted dates. There are controversies. But anyway, Mahabharata war took place somewhere in 3300s, between 3300 and 3400. That's the most historically accepted date of Mahabharata war, BC, before Christ. And then there is Buddha, who belonged to the 6th century of 6th century BC. That is about 2500 years after Sri Krishna. The next important phase, stage in the evolution of Indian spiritual tradition is Shankaracharya, who lived in 8th century AD. And the most contemporary, the current phase that we are going through is the period of Sri Ramakrishna and Vivekananda, who actually did what Sri Krishna did in 3rd millennium BC, and Buddha in the 6th century BC, and Shankara in 8th century AD. The same evolutionary transformation was brought upon Hindu tradition, Vedic heritage, by Sri Ramakrishna Vivekananda in the 19th century. So you can see the time period from 3300 BC up to 1900. Vast span of time. Historically speaking, you know, Sri Krishna belongs to what we may call prehistoric period. But among the great thinkers and philosophers who belong to historic period, whose life we can all understand from historical records, is Buddha, Shankara, and Sri Ramakrishna Vivekananda phenomenon in 19th century. That's about 1200 years of 2400 years of India's spiritual history. 2400 years, that means 24 centuries. After Buddha, Shankara came in 8th century, roughly around 8th century, that's 1200 years after Buddha. 1200 years after Shankaracharya, Vivekananda came. So altogether, 2400 years of recorded history we have got right in front of us. Now, what did Buddha do? You know, when we do puja here, we utter one mantra, Nininda Vedam Pashughatanam Vai. That is an important reference to Buddha's activities, Buddha's contribution to Indian culture, world culture. That's one line of the four lines couplet that we chant during puja. Nininda Vedam Pashughatanam Vai. So, that part of Vedic heritage which popularized and supported animal sacrifices, Buddha led a revolution against it. He revolted against it. He did not do that by bringing together violent forces, organizing a mass revolution, a violent revolution as it happened in French Revolution or in Cultural Revolution China or in 1917 in Tsarist Russia. It was not a violent revolution, some violent forces coming together and destroying everything, and in the process of refining succeeded only in destroying the existing order without replacing it with something else, certainly replaced with something much worse. Now, what Buddha did, Buddha said, religion should be humanistic. It should serve the needs of the common man in the streets. For that, he expounded a spiritual paradigm emphasizing the reality of the incompleteness of empirical life, money, wealth and status, all these things come and go. They can only present before you a sense of inner incompleteness or inner imperfection, which is called dukkham, chatvari adi satyani, four noble truths which he uttered. And in order to solve this problem, he propounded what could be called the most comprehensive philosophical concept of spiritual humanism, that is the Eightfold Noble Path. Samyak Drishti, Samyak Vyayama, Samyak Ajiva, Samyak Vak, Samyak Sankalpa, Samyak Samadhi, and so on. We will discuss this in the course of time. You should act, talk, think, and live in a righteous manner, in an appropriate manner, upholding the principle of dharma. He propounded this theory. He gave a humanistic interpretation of Vedic heritage without revolting, without actually violently changing anything, but rather he made his own contribution, which caused a natural sublimation of the existing order. So that's why it's called, it was evolution, actually speaking. It is not revolution. But I have to use that term because that is the only word by which we today describe a radical change from within and from without. We don't normally distinguish. But in the course of the talk, I want to emphasize this point. Buddha and Shankaracharya were not revolutionaries in the ordinary accepted meaning of the word. They were making evolutionary contributions, creative, constructive contributions. So this was the great contribution of Buddha. Now about Shankaracharya. Now we had to travel 200 years from Buddha to Shankaracharya. Buddha presented before us a very wonderful humanistic philosophy. But it was completely forgotten in 8th century AD. See, what happened to Buddhism outside India and within India are two different things, historically speaking. That's why today you find in India, a traditional Hindu will look upon Buddha as a great spiritual incarnation, the way they look upon their own spiritual incarnations. But they do not believe in many of the Buddhist tenets. That's because Buddhism within India became a kind of iconoclastic nihilism. Shunyavada and Vijnanavada together had taken Buddhism from its emphasis on these noble truths and eightfold disciplines, what we call the humanistic aspect of Buddhism, found in the Tripitakas, Sutta Pitaka, Vinaya Pitaka, and Abhidhamma Pitaka, in which Buddha expounded a sublime humanistic interpretation of Vedanta or Vedic philosophy. So it was completely forgotten, and in its place, a lot of nihilistic, iconoclastic, world-denying ideas had already crept into Buddhist fold, even in India. But it did not happen in other countries where Buddhism began to spread from 2nd century BC onwards. You know, Buddhism went to China. From there it went to Siam, Laos, Cambodia, Korea, Vietnam, of course Japan, in a much more comprehensive way. So in those countries, it grew, it evolved, incorporating and accommodating many of the traditional values of these cultures. But within India, what happened was it took a different turn. It was divided into four important schools of later Buddhism, Sautrantika and Vaibhashika, Vijnanavada and Shunyavada. Two of them belong to Hinayana school and two of them belong to Mahayana school. And then the Vajrayana school, which mostly centered in Tibet. Many of these ideas had become somewhat dry nihilism and iconoclastic way of life. So Shankara came in 8th century. He did not reject Buddhism. He took all the humanistic elements from Buddhism. So perhaps many of you may not be fully aware of this fact. The way we do puja today, the way we install a temple today, you know, pradishtha, the mantras we chant, the forms of worship that we practice within the Ramakrishna order, you know, you may have heard of Sopachara puja, 16 elements, Panchopachara, 5 elements, Dasopachara, 10 elements. All these come from Shankaracharya's teachings. He wrote a well-known devotional poem, Chatushashti Upachara Puja Stotram. It is a long poem in Sanskrit which narrate and explain and illustrate the most comprehensive way of worship involving no less than 64 upachara, 64 forms of worship. Ushasi Magada Mangala Jardi, Jardi Jagrudi Jagrudi. You know, O Mother, so the all-pervading divine energy, the omnipresent divine energy, is invoked to be present on the image or on the photo or in the whatever it, the pratika, the symbol in front of you. So you need a focus, you need a point for concentration, for focusing your mind. For that, there's an image. An image is not God. Image is only a means, an instrument, just a tool for taking your mind away from external objects and focusing on something. Remember, that's often maybe not fully understood by our temple priests. But the fact is, an image is not God, not goddess. See, when you have a photo of Lakshmi, Saraswati, Shiva, Vishnu, whatever it is, don't think that image is God. That'd be very ridiculous. The image is only a focus that you need to eventually focus on the imageless, the formless God. You need a form. See, your mind is being dragged into all kinds of external objects. That mind should be withdrawn within, drawn inward. Mind will not listen to you. Come inside, you won't come. But you need an instrument. So you have a picture, you have a symbol, and which you consider to be, in a way, not perfectly, but approximately, which represents some of the attributes we normally give to the divine reality, and you focus on it. And eventually you should be able to realize the presence of this omnipresent divine energy within your own self. It is called, you know, from sarvandaryamitvat, that is andaryamitvam. Shankaracharya mentions an important point in the Brahma Sutra. Sarvandarya, you see, from all omnipresence to immanence. First, you think of God as being present everywhere. Eventually, you should be able to realize His presence within your own self and within everything in the world. Such kind of spiritual humanism. For that, He elaborated these 64 types of worship. And He's the one who actually behind most of the famous, most famous Hindu temples in India today. All the way from Badrinath right up to southern corner, from Kashmir to the southern corner, you find Shankaracharya's footsteps. You know, Shankaracharya, his birthplace is called Kaladi. In the vernacular, it means your foot, that means feet. So, actually, his feet, his footmark could be found all over India. He traveled all over Indian subcontinent 4 times. Okay, now coming to another aspect. He's the one who actually gave shape to the monastic order of which we are a part. He founded 10 monastic orders. Of which, you know, this Chinmayananda, Shivananda Saraswati, the great Swami who popularized yoga. He belonged to one of the monastic orders founded by Shankaracharya called Saraswati. And we belong to a monastic order founded by Shankaracharya called Puri. So practically, there is nothing we have in India or within Hinduism which doesn't really come from Shankaracharya. And you know how he did this? He did not one day call all people together, let us fight against the existing order. He didn't do that. What he did, he made his own contribution. He refined it. He sublimated it. He caused it to evolve. He did not change it. He caused it to grow. So growth and change are two important things. We should remember that very well. Growth and change. Growth implies evolution. Change implies change very often imposed upon an existing order, which may lead to tragic consequences. Even, you know, for example, in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you find Sri Ramakrishna says, bhakti and jnana, devotion and the path of knowledge, they lead to the same goal. Now, this is the statement from the Gospel. Sri Ramakrishna expounds this idea. At the experience level, the highest devotee who worships in a temple or a church or a synagogue, any place of worship, and the highest philosopher who concentrates on the all-pervading, formless, attributeless reality, both mean the same. If you are a devotee, you are not different from a philosopher. Now, you know, this statement historically comes from Shankaracharya's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita Bhashyam, 13th chapter, 11th dosh, Maicha Ananya Yogena Bhakti Ravibhijarini Vivikta Desha Sevitum Anabhirjana Samsati. Shankaracharya is defining in this Sanskrit verse from the Gita the nature of the purest, unwavering devotion to God. Avibhijarini bhakti. He defines na vibhijarana sila, shuddha, nirmala, achala, unchanging, unwavering, pure devotion to God. And the highest spiritual philosophy, the path of knowledge, are the same. After defining elaborately avibhijarini bhakti, that means unwavering devotion to God, he says, in a small single sentence, sacha jnanam, means that bhakti, that devotion is also the highest knowledge. Now, today you can find, those of you who have gone to India may have heard of this conflict between Shiva, Vishnu, Shakta, Shaiva, Ganapatya, Saura. There were different denominations within India. It came, it evolved in course of time. So, what Shankaracharya did was, he evolved a unique system of worship. He gave a new dimension, a new spiritual definition to the existing forms of worship that he found in 8th century AD. He did not deny anything, he did not reject anything, but he gave a sublime definition, a sublime possibility, a higher spiritual possibility to each of these existing rituals and schools of spiritual thought. So you find the worship of sun, the worship of Divine Mother, the worship of Ganapati, the worship of Shiva, Vishnu, Kumara, Subramani, all these you find. What he did, you know, there were hundreds, maybe thousands of types of worship existing in India. What he did not one day say, well, you know, ex ecclusiam nulla silus. He didn't do that. This is the only path. There is no other way. He didn't say. He said, all right, you follow all this. But remember, in each of these traditions that you follow, there's a higher possibility. Because as you evolve in spiritual life, your idea of God also evolves. You know, our idea of God very often depends upon our own cultural spiritual evolution. At the beginning, we may think, my God sits in my temple. Your God sits in your place. We are all, so we should fight each other. That is the primitive, that is the, you know, children fight for candies. But grown-up people don't fight for candies unless they want to be certified. So as we evolve in spiritual life, we don't care for these minor differences. As we grow in spiritual life, our own idea of God also grows. And as we reach the highest level, we are able to see the God whom you worship in the temple. You are able to see that God outside the temple also. Those who believe that God exists only in the place of worship alone, and those 2 hours you spend in a place of worship is spiritual, the other 22 hours you spend outside the place of worship is secular. They are only kindergarten students in spiritual life. As we evolve in spiritual life, you should be able to see the presence of God in everyone, in everything. So the idea that secular is different from spiritual was rejected by Shankaracharya. He says the secular also has got a spiritual dimension. So he was the one who gave us a complete religio-philosophical system. So that's why I mentioned, you know, as I mentioned earlier, he founded the way we worship in the temple. He called Panchayatana Puja. 5 deities, you know, Aditya, Ambika, Vishnu, Ganapati, Shiva, and so on. And he's called Shanmada Sthapaka Acharya, Shiva, Vishnu, all these different deities. So practically what you find in Shankaracharya's teaching is, even when he talks about a monotheistic God, he presents a monistic possibility. A person who believes that Shiva is the only God, or you know, there are some groups who believe Krishna is the only God. All others are Krishna's subordinates. But Shankaracharya would not admit that. He says, a person who sincerely worships God as Krishna will realize the same truth which a person who considers Christ as the Supreme God, or a person who believes Shiva as Supreme God. If we are sincere, pure, honest, and lead a pure life, then as we grow in spiritual life, we find spiritual unity in our own spiritual life. So the goal is the same, and the paths may differ. That's why we often find him as the exponent of Panchayatana Puja, Panchadevata Puja, and also is called Shanmada Sthapaka Acharya, and so on. So I'm just giving, this is only an introduction to serve, you know. That means what I wanted to emphasize was, Shankaracharya was not a revolutionary, or Buddha was not a revolutionary in the ordinary accepted definition or meaning of the word revolutionary. I don't think there is a word called evolutionary. It's only said, it can only be an adjective. It cannot be a noun or a qualifier. So I'm using the word, he was the one who brought about a spiritual revolution through evolution. That means nobody need to reject the existing order. You can refine and process and sublimate the existing order. When you grow in spiritual life, you become a better human beings. When we grow in spiritual life, our approach to God also evolves, and simultaneously, our understanding of humanity, our interaction with humanity, our approach to life also evolves. This unique idea was brought up by Shankaracharya. That's why, you know, one of his signal contributions from a ontological point of view, from a metaphysical point of view, is the analysis of the absolute reality from 3 perspectives, which is called Paramarthika, Vyavahariga, and Pratibhasika, Satta. I shall try to explain this. Maybe Sanskrit terms may look a bit obscure, but very simple. What he says is, as I mentioned earlier, as we evolve, our understanding of God, our understanding of the absolute reality, our understanding of a spiritual destination also will evolve, grow. Then, at some point, we will be able to look upon the all-pervading divine presence of God as the only absolute reality, unchanging reality. Then what about the changing things that we encounter in our everyday life? Pain and pleasure, success and failure, profit and loss, the good and bad, the pleasant and the unpleasant, the good friends and enemies. We can see these equations, these contradictions, dualities in our everyday life. Wealth, money, status, health all come and go. They are changing. He says these are all changing realities. They are not unreal, but you should not look upon them as permanent things, as we all know. We may know intellectually these things are not permanent, but we often forget in real life. When you return from the crematorium, you forget the reality that this body also may go the same way. So we forget it. So Shankaracharya says we must always remember the changeability of empirical things and the unchanging nature of the one reality which is omnipresent, which is everywhere. It's called Paramarthika Satta. The other is called empirical reality, called Vyavaharika Satta. And there are things that we do not encounter except in memories and dreams or imaginations, which are not totally unreal because they must have a background and empirical life. So they are called Pradibhasika Satta. So these are all his unique contributions to world thought. The idea is, through this analysis, what he did was he permanently rejected the claims of all kinds of exclusivistic claims. He says, any person who is sincere, honest, who lives a pure life, can find his spiritual goal, no matter what tradition he belongs. Even you'll be surprised when I tell you that his system of Advaita philosophy is the only existing spiritual philosophy that can accept even a non-believer in God as spiritual. You can even be a spiritual person without being a conventional believer in God. You may believe, in fact, Vivekananda taking this idea from Advaita philosophy makes a very strong, forceful statement. He says, you live your life in such a way that God will accept you even if you do not accept him. That is absurd. That means true spirituality goes beyond mechanical faith in God. Faith is only the kindergarten of spiritual life. Experience is the real ultimate purpose of spiritual life. And in fact, he made some very strong statements in this context also. I can just... He says, Anubhava avasanatvat bhudavastu visayatvaja brahmajnanasya. He comes in the... In the Brahma Sutra Bhashya, Anubhava avasanatvat bhudavastu visayatvaja brahmajnanasya. Anubhava avasanatvat bhudavastu visayatvaja brahmajnanasya. The two statements coming one after another in his commentaries. What he says is, the ultimate criterion, judgment, the tool of judgment that proves you are a spiritual person is your experience and not your belief or faith. Mechanical faith, mechanical belief are necessary, no doubts. You have to believe in something. You should have a faith, strong faith. Without that, you cannot live according to certain important disciplines. But that is not the end of spiritual life. What he emphasizes is, faith is necessary. Belief is necessary, books are necessary, rituals are necessary. All these factors are necessary. But ultimate goal is not faith. Faith is not a university, faith is only primary school. Belief is only primary school or kindergarten. The ultimate goal of spiritual life is one's own experience. When we experience this, then we cannot fight or quarrel in the name of God, religion, culture, or nationality. That's why, you know, you find a slogan in Shankaracharya's commentary. Srutya, Yuktiya, Swanubhutya. Sruti, the Vedic statements. Yukti, our reason. Anubhava means experience. You read books, the revealed scriptures, the great doctrines you read, the works of great sages, teachers of different religious traditions you read. It's called Sruti. Sruti actually means Veda. Sruti anenaiti, dharma anenaiti, Sruti. There are different definitions. Sruti means, Sruti is in a way revealed scriptures of Vedas. Brahmadinam labhanda idi Veda, that is Shankaracharya's statement. But the highest purpose of a divine book, a divine scripture, a holy scripture, is not to make you just a believer in the doctrines or dogmas of that book. A true holy book should take you beyond words, beyond book. The truth is, the ultimate destination is our own experience. For that, we need a book. We need doctrines. But they do not constitute the highest reach of spiritual life. That's why, you know, Sruti, scriptures, read them. Then Yukti, he says, and that's something very revolutionary. He tells you, you should use your reason. That's something very interesting. You know, the extent to which Shankaracharya carried his rational thinking, his spiritual revolutionary idea, becomes obvious when you read his books and he tells you, do not believe blindly all the words you read in books. He says, Yuktya means by reasoning. You should use your own intelligence. Experience may go beyond reasoning, but experience should not contradict reasoning. You know, you should remember this very well. Spiritual experience goes beyond, transcends reasoning. But spiritual experience should not contradict reasoning. Transcending is one thing. Contradiction is another thing. There are many things that we experience. We cannot rationally explain. Reason fails to explain many things that we know to be true in our own experience. Reason cannot give a full explanation to many of the higher spiritual experiences that we experience. So you should say, those experiences are real, but reason is an inadequate tool to explain that, which means experiences go beyond reasoning. That's why read books, then use yukti, means reasoning, then swanubhutya, one's own inner experience. So that was his slogan. That means faith, mechanical doctrines and dogmatism have no place in Vedanta. And what about his ethics, his humanism? There is a lingering criticism against Advaita. And I have come across this criticism even in books from which we do not normally expect that. That's a problem of understanding Shankara's ethical philosophy. You know, the greatest Christian theologian who approximately comes close to Shankaracharya was Meister Eckhart, who lived in 13th century Germany. He wrote his books in Old German. And during the last 200 years, there was an attempt to revive his philosophy. He was such a great thinker. And if you read Rudolf Otto's interpretation of Eckhartian theology. He was a great theologian. So also Otto was a theologian, a German theologian. If you read Eckhart's ideas, you may be struck by the similarity, and you may even believe that Eckhart was influenced by Advaita. But there is no chance to believe in that, because there was a gap of nearly 500 years between Shankara and Eckhart. Eckhart came almost 500 years after Shankaracharya. So there is always a problem in understanding Advaita. If God is present everywhere and is present in us, then what's the place of ethics and morality in Vedanta? It's a big question. Now, I have come across some very intriguing statements, even in Rudolf Otto, where he himself is not able to fully understand the ethical philosophy of Advaitacharya, because that's always a problem. It's not deliberate. Unless you read these great books from a traditional teacher, and if you read only from translations, you will be terribly misled. That could happen to me if I read just the translations of Kant, who was not a theologian, who was a philosopher, or Eckhart, who was a theologian. I may not fully understand, or I may not understand as well as I could understand if I read the original works. This is much more true for students of Vedanta. I'm not just pouring cold water among people who are trying to make sense of Advaita. What I mean to say, if there is a difficulty in understanding, it's only the difficulty of language, not of the contents. See, Shankaracharya, in his commentary on one very well-known verse in the Mandukya Karika, so siddhanta vyavasthasu dvaitino nischita dhidham parasparam virudhyante taihi ayam na virudhyate. This is from Gaudapada's Karika, which he wrote, is a commentary in metrical form in verses on one of the Upanishads called Mandukya Upanishad. The meaning is this: those who are not Advaitins, those who do not believe in non-dualism, they fight among themselves because they think my God is only right God. Your God is not God. This was true in India also. There were a lot of quarrels, not violent physical fights, but polemical confrontations, dialectical confrontations, philosophical debates between Shaivas, Shaktas, Vaishnavas, and so on in India for centuries. Debates, long discussions. So those who follow Shiva will tell you Shiva is the only God. And those who follow Krishna, Krishna is the only God. More like our own times. But they never resorted to physical confrontations, mostly intellectual debates. That's a saving factor, of course. Now, Shankaracharya, referring to them, tells you, those who believe that their path alone is the only path, not, that is, those who do not accept the reality that one supreme truth is the ultimate destination of our spiritual journey, such people believe that their path is only path. Their goal is only goal. They fight among themselves. Then he says, in his commentary on this particular verse, he says, but we Advaitins have no quarrel with them. Because if they follow their own path sincerely and practice and reach the experience dimension of their own path, they will have no quarrel. They will find one common ground at the spiritual experience. So he says, asmadiyoyam vaidiko dharma na viruddhiti taihi anyone virodhibhihi asmadiyoyam vaidiko dharma na viruddhiti yadha sukhasta padadibhissata. Means, see, you don't fight with your own hand, your own head. You hit your head. My head, I don't like you. So with your right fist, you hit your head. You feel the pain. If you torture one part of your physical body with another part, you feel the pain. Similarly, When we hurt others, we are hurting ourselves because there is no otherness. The whole world is one spiritual family. Though creation, not only world, creation, you know, I chanted this verse, you know, Deva Shanti, Randareksham Shanti, Prithivi Shanti, Roshadaya Shanti, Vanaspataya Shanti. The earth, the heavens, the oceans, the mountains and valleys and forests, let them all be peaceful. Let there be peace and blessedness everywhere. So a kind of spiritual affinity, not only with the human creation, but the whole creation as a whole. If you pollute the water, pollute the air, pollute the sky, you're actually doing harm to yourself. This kind of spiritual affinity, unity and oneness of the whole existence, this is the essence of Vedanta. That's why Advaita. So Advaita is a unique, universal, spiritual, ethical system. And another very interesting, of course, just incidentally, when I referred to the greatest figure in Christian theology, he was an Advaitin, really speaking. He was Mr. Eckhart, I mentioned just now. He was buried, he was forgotten for centuries. Then another German thinker, 19th century, Rudolf Otto, who is well known as the author of the Mysticism East and West, he revived, he made a great contribution in the revival of Eckhartian theology, which is now, of course, very popular, partly because of the popularity of Advaita, thanks to Swami Vivekananda's advent in the modern Western world. So after he spread this Advaita philosophy, theologians in other religious traditions also discovered the value of Advaitic, non-dualistic teachings in their own traditions. Now, of course, you should remember it started before Vivekananda, even Schopenhauer happened to read the Latin translations of the Upanishads, translated by Duperon. And later, of course, I'm not going to that part of the story because there's not enough time. So what I want to tell you is there's a striking similarity between Eckhartian approach to the absolute reality and Shankaracharya's approach to the absolute reality. Now, there is a verse in the Mandukya Upanishad. Those of you who want to read, you can get the book from our book. Seventh mantra of Mandukya Upanishad, which has got 12 mantras. The seventh mantra tries to explain the reality by explaining what it is not. It is technically called Vaya Negativa or negative theology in Christian tradition. And Meister Eckhart was the greatest exponent of this concept. That is, trying to explain the absolute reality because it is beyond words, beyond description, beyond definition, beyond explanation. So all that you can do while explaining what is beyond explanation is you have to explain what it is not, and what is left out is the absolute reality. Describing something by saying what it is not. It's called Vaya Negativa or negative theology. Now, there is a verse, Nanta Prakyam, the Bhir Prakyam, Ubhayada Prakyam, Na Prakyanaghanam, Na Prakyam, Na Prakyam, etc. It is not inwardly cognitive, it is not outwardly cognitive, it is not both, and it continues. The indescribability of the absolute reality is demonstrated by exhausting all possible explanations, thereby implying that it is beyond explanation. Now, this was a unique contribution of Meister Eckhart to Christian theology. Partly the reason why he was buried or forgotten was this was not exactly, and the mainstream church was not exactly amused by the teachings of a great theologian who said that the absolute reality in its highest form transcends even the Trinity. So even the word God itself doesn't exhaust all the spiritual possibilities of God who cannot be explained in words. Now, this was the highest reach in the evolution of Christian theology. You can see these striking parallels in Vedanta and Advaita Vedanta and Christian theology. Now, so see, in fact, this is actually the first important statement of Vaya Negativa comes in Rigveda Samhita, 10th Mandala. Nasadasi, Nosadasi, it's called Him Creation, that is Srishti Suktam, Nasadiya Suktam in the Rigveda Samhita. So, on the one hand, it takes you to the highest peak of philosophical, metaphysical speculation. On the other hand, it provides before you, presents before you, a universal, a comprehensive ethical philosophy, which tells you you should not do harm to another person. It doesn't say that you should not do harm, you should not harm another person because God will punish you. The real reason is by doing harm to another person, you are doing harm to yourself. You cannot hurt another person without hurting yourself. If you hurt another one, you are hurting yourself spiritually. So this idea of oneness and unity of existence was a unique contribution of Shankaracharya. Now, to understand Shankara, you can refer to Buddha. To understand Buddha, you can refer to Shankara. See, Buddha was born, as I mentioned earlier, in the 6th century BC. You know what he did? He was born a prince. He was the son of a king in today's Nepal. And he was brought up in an atmosphere of luxury. He didn't have any problems. He was married. He was 28 years old. In Buddha's history, it is said that he was the greatest martial artist, the greatest soldier of his time. He defeated all the... I mean, he was not an imbecile. People think, oh, he was sitting under a tree. He must be quite weak and good-for-nothing fellow. In fact, I had to face this question. No, Buddha had everything that was positive for a king. He could have become a great emperor, conqueror. But one day, when he was just about 28 years old, he was being taken out in a chariot. And he had three visions. An old man with his miserable face, a sick man, and a dead body being taken to the cremation ground. These three visions rattled him, shocked him, devastated him, and made him realize the darker side of human life, which he had never encountered till then. It is said that when he was born, the astrologer made a prediction that either he is going to be a big conquering emperor or he'll become an emperor of ascetics. So his parents did not want him to become the emperor of an ascetic. No pain, no, they were not amused by that prediction. So they did not let him see anything about the unpleasantness of human life. So one day, 28 years old, a young man who had never seen a sick man, a dead man, happened to see, oh, there is such a thing as old age, death and sickness. What is this? I am also going to face the same thing at some point in future. So he thought, and that night he left his palace, left behind his kingdom, his comforts, his ministers, everything, walked 1200 miles, reached Bodh Gaya in today's Bihar state, sat under a tree with a strong resolve. Iha sane sushyudhi me sharidam tugasti vamsam cha vilayam chiyathu aprapasiddhim bhu janma durlabham naivasanat kaya matascalishyade. I'm quoting this verse from a 2nd century biography of Buddha in Sanskrit. It's called Lalita Vistara, which is the most accepted authentic biography of Buddha in verses. Buddha's resolve, what he said to himself as he sat under the tree to meditate, to discover the truth behind life, is this. I'm going to sit under this tree. That's a translation. Let my body perish. Let my body be reduced to ashes and bones, let them wither away. I won't get up from this seat before I get the highest enlightenment. And in course of time, he got enlightenment. So he became Buddha. Siddhartha became Buddha. Siddhartha means, you know, one who has received what he was looking for. And that is the meaning of Siddhartha in Sanskrit. Buddha means the enlightened one. So the evolution from Siddhartha the prince to Buddha the world teacher, it didn't take a long distance. So what happened to Buddha? He found the religious rituals, the practices that were going on in the name of religion in his time, in 6th century, very, very diabolical, very, very revolting, very outrageous. The whole story and the nature of the type of spiritual revolution that he represented could be sensed by this interesting narrative that you find in Buddha's own biography. At that time, Bimbisara was the king, the emperor of Magadha. And at that time, Magadha empire practically extended all the way from Sri Lanka right up to Samarkand, from south to north, and all the way from Burma to Afghanistan. That is a huge land area that is the emperor, that is the empire of Magadha's. So it extended right up to the border of today's Iran or Persia. It's a huge land geographical area. So R.C. Majumdar has written a well-known book in which he has given a graphic presentation of the Magadha Empire, the time of Kanishka, and before that, of course, the early days of Bimbisara dynasty. So anyway, I'm going to those details. Now the point is, one day Buddha was walking and he was walking as a wanderer. He had already become a world famous teacher of that locality. So he found a cowherd was driving a large number of sheep to the king's palace. The king was holding a big ritual. Very often rituals involving animal sacrifices, which actually Vedas do not sanction, but it was a revolting deviation from the central teachings of the Vedas. So Buddha found a small little lamb was limping. So he asked the permission of the cow of the shepherd, "Would you permit me to hold this lamb? Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to the emperor's court for the big ritual involving animal sacrifices." Buddha sought this shepherd's permission, who perhaps did not know who Buddha was. Will you permit me to carry this lamb? Because it is limping. One of his feet is hurt. So the shepherd gave permission. As they reached the palace, Buddha told the king, the emperor, "Well, you want to sacrifice these animals? All right. Could you do a small favor? Instead of this small lamb, you can sacrifice me." And that completely brought up a complete transformation, a complete change in the attitude of the emperor. He stopped animal sacrifice then and there. This was the language he used for his revolution. That is what's called Buddha's spiritual revolution. He did not reject anyone. He did not revolt against anybody. When he requested the emperor to substitute his life instead of taking the life of the little lamb, the emperor was practically shocked. Then he wanted to know, "Who are you? Please come and sit. I want to listen to you." And that was the beginning of a new chapter in the history of Magadha Empire. Now, this was the kind of spiritual revolution that Buddha represented. So Buddha did more or less at the physical level. Shankara did at the level of spiritual, philosophical level. Shankara had to be a revolutionary at a physical level. Sorry, at the philosophical level, spiritual level. Buddha was a revolutionary both at the spiritual and also at the physical level, because that was the kind of change that is needed at the time. So about Shankaracharya's philosophical contribution, there is a well-known verse. You see, the Ajnanandar Gahanapadidan Atmavidyopadeshehi Tradum Lokan Bhavadava Sikhatapa Papachyamanan Muktva Maunam Vatavidapino Muladon Nishpadanti Sambho Murti Saridhi Bhuvane Shankaracharya Rupa. What it says is, Shiva is conceived to be Dakshinamurti in the popular Hindi tradition. He is the eternal teacher of all the worlds, sitting under a tree in perpetual silence. Now, this verse tells you, he is the great teacher, Shiva, is sitting under a tree in silence. He is teaching through the language of silence. But that Shiva had to speak through the language of philosophy and spiritual revolution in the form of Shankaracharya in modern times. Sri Shankaracharya is the dynamic edition of the static splinter who walked abroad delighting in the sustenance of his Vada Bhiksha, speaking words of Vedantic wisdom to rescue Sanatana Dharma, the spiritual tradition of mankind. It's an interesting verse. Buddha brought about a revolution by presenting the humanistic face of Vedantic spiritual heritage. That was the need of 6th century BC. Shankaracharya in 8th century AD did the same from a metaphysical, from a spiritual, and also from the philosophical level. Buddhist philosophy actually did not exist during Buddha's time. I want to remind this, this is very important to remember. All the Buddhist philosophical ideas that you do today you find in Vipassana or mindfulness, all these were philosophical interpretations of Buddha's teachings, which actually began in the 2nd century AD, almost 300 years after Buddha's passing away, or 280 years after Buddha's passing away. That's something to remember. All the Shunyavada, doctrine of emptiness, Vijnanavada, subjective idealism, the realistic schools of Sautrantika and Vaibhashika, all these great Buddhist philosophical doctrines emerged 250 years after Buddha's passing away. Buddha himself emphasized the most elementary disciplines, humanistic disciplines, that we need to live a happy, undisturbed, peaceful life in this world. Peaceful in our interaction with the world and others. So, Buddha gave a humanistic dimension to Vedanta. Shankaracharya gave a philosophic dimension. But spirituality was present in both their teachings. So, that's why I emphasized at the beginning the difference between revolution and evolution. Buddha and Shankaracharya brought about a spiritual revolution through evolution. And evolution means a change from within. There is no friction, no conflict. Nothing is lost, nothing is disturbed. A child evolves, grows into a youth. A youth becomes a middle-aged man, an old man. Old age is not imposed upon him. Is natural, spontaneous, inherent evolution. So that is the language of these great thinkers, Buddha and Shankara. The spiritual revolution was accomplished in the form of spiritual evolution, that is growth from within. So I tried to give just a bird view of these great thinkers and their contribution to world thought. And if there are any questions you would like to ask, you are most welcome during interaction. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Paramastu.